episode 1128, you put the U in universalism.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Ed Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono. We're back.
We're back to talk about something that I feel like we touched on this during a recent episode, but which episode was it? It was in the...
I think it was in the extra feed, wasn't it?
Yeah, but
what were we talking about? We were talking about
something... It was
something,
last week.
Something with Catholics.
I mean, we did the rosary episode.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that, right?
Well,
was it during the Passion of Joan of Arc?
I don't think so.
Maybe it was the rosary episode.
Maybe it was the Roger Moore.
All right, listeners, a few weeks back, Ben and I recorded an episode for the Patreon feed, which you can find at patreon.com/thesci-fi-christian. We have a bunch of extra episodes there. I mean, hundreds for only $3 a month, or if you want to get uncensored, $7 a month.
Yeah, but maybe it was the Joan of Arc one, and we got talking on something. I feel like it was an aside.
I think it might have been Rosary, but either way, I'm going to tease the Rosary episode because we don't do this very often. But Ben's going to be out of town next week, and as we're doing this episode on the Rosary, I just felt like this should be shared on the main feed for free.
Can I tell you something about that episode? So yeah. What that episode was is you were gifted a rosary
by a family member.
And so you were just curious what it was. So we kind of went through the rosary. I'll tell you something. This is like patting myself on the back. That episode has revived my own devotion to the rosary. I've prayed the rosary every single day since then. It's been a wonderful, very wonderful experience. So I recommend the rosary and I recommend our rosary episode. I did a great job.
Good job, Ben. Yes. So next.
It hasn't cultivated humility yet, but I'm sure that's coming.
So the next episode here in the main feed while Ben's out of town will be that rosary episode. Again, we don't often move the Patreon feed episodes into the main feed, but I feel this is a good time to make an exception because it was a valuable episode.
I agree. I think it turned out really well. So, but somewhere along the lines, whether it was that episode or another one, I think I made an aside comment that could have been interpreted as pro-universalism.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly what I think I said something to the effect of that we don't know for sure that anybody is in hell.
Do you think it was in the What the Facts episode?
Could have been. I don't know.
That was here in the main feed.
I don't know.
Yeah, anyways, let's move on from when it was.
Yeah, but I said something to the effect of, we don't know for sure that anybody is in hell.
Yeah.
Which
I picked up on.
I know what I meant, but that was probably not the best aside because that's a confusing statement without diving in and explaining it more, because it could have sounded and probably did sound to you and to the other listeners that I am endorsing universalism, which would be a strong stance to take, especially in a footnote moment of the show. So we kind of discussed it briefly in whatever episode that was, and then we wanted to come back and have an actual discussion about universalism.
And it was perfect timing because I mentioned one family member gave me a rosary. A different family member brought up with me just a few days ago, I'm saying like 3 or 4 days ago, a non-Christian family member, out of nowhere. There was almost no primer for this conversation.
Yeah.
They just dove into, how do people that have never heard of Jesus get to heaven? So he basically was just saying, so is everyone just screwed? Like if they never hear, do they just have to go to hell? And I don't know if he was trying to poke holes in the faith or if he was actually interested in what the answer was. And so we kind of talked some things through, you and I messaged back and forth after the fact. But I don't know, that could be something we could get into here potentially if it fits in.
Yeah, I mean, it very much does, because that's the question, right? Is like, how does that work? How does hell work? So let me first maybe get at what I was talking about, like the point I was trying to make, which is not intended as an endorsement of universalism, because I'm not one, but I'm going to stop. Let me back up. Few things I want to accomplish in this episode. Number one, I want to explain my aside a little bit better than I did So if you heard about it or just hearing about it now, you can understand what I was actually getting at. Number two, I want to break down the term universalism, which we've probably done a little bit of in the past, but I'm sure it's been years, because I think that universalism is a little bit too broad of a catch-all term. And within that term, there are beliefs that I would consider heretical and beliefs that are at least potentially compatible with the faith. And then number three, I'll tell you what I actually believe on this, because I do, because so let's go back to the first one, my little side, where I said something to the effect of, we don't know for sure that anybody's in hell. So a couple of things that are going on there when I make a statement like that. I try and train myself to talk in such a way where I'm careful about making definitive statements where I don't feel one is warranted. I do that on purpose. It's actually a way of thinking for myself. I even do that in terms of just how I think about things, because I want to be careful when I talk that I don't talk in such a way that closes me off from possibilities that should not be closed off. As an example of this type of thinking, working with my son, who's 13, he's learning to read all these great books. You know, he's reading Plato on his own. Like, I'm not telling him he has to read this stuff. He's read some Kafka. He's reading Hemingway and Dickens. It's like, he's just really, like, this world is opening up to him. And as a result, some things that maybe he was into before, or other family members, or other actual school assignments, feel like they pale in comparison at times. So we've had a number of actually really good discussions around these lines. But one of the traps that he's fallen into is saying, this is pointless, in reference to either something that we're doing as a family or a school assignment or something like that. Now, sometimes I think he's right, but I made a rule for him as we were talking. I said, you and I can talk about any of this. I'm not going to be mad at you if you feel like you don't like this or anything like that, but you don't get to say this is pointless. You get to say, I don't see the point. Those are two very different statements. One of them shuts off the possibility of discussion. I can't respond to the statement, this is pointless. That's just a closed door statement. The statement, I don't see the point, opens you up to conversation. That's something you can, because then I can say, well, I do, and here it is. And then we can enter into conversation about those ideas. So I bring that up as a prolonged example of, I try and speak that way very deliberately, and I've trained myself to use that type of language over the years, because it actually impacts how I think about things. That it's like a combination of having a strong opinion on something, but an opinion that is open to conversation with other opinions, which is the right way to do it. And that's what I was trying to teach my son. Like, the wrong lesson for him would be, back off your opinion. You know, you don't know, like introducing uncertainty for him. Like, no, have your opinion, have it as strong as you want to have it, but phrase it to others and to yourself, because that's the key part here, in a way where you're in conversation with other opinions. That's the key. So I try and do the same thing. So, and this I'm sure is frustrating at times. And I know, like, we've had different topics where you've tried to push me to, well, like, I'm thinking of the historicity of the Bible or something like this. You could probably think back on some of those conversations, because I'm doing this left, right, and center there. Like, where there isn't a defined, definite opinion, either in terms of what we can know about the nature of the text, or just what I'm interested in, or what the church teaches, I'm very hesitant to come out and say, this, you know, plant my flag on something. And some of that in those cases is, I'm just not terribly interested in that side of the question. We've discussed that a lot. Okay, so all of this, very roundabout way to come back to last things, whether we mean end times or the afterlife or anything like that. Like, there are things that the church teaches and there are things that it doesn't. And there are things that, and those, even that's saying a little too much, because it's not as though there's just these two categories. There's things that the church teaches about, and then there's things that we can read a little bit on. So one of the things the church teaches about is that hell is a very real place. You know, so in contrast to the Rob Bells of the world, where it's like, well, you know, that's just reference to the word Gehenna was referring to this garbage dump outside of Jerusalem, which is true. It's like, yeah, okay, but obviously, that's not the point, and that's not how the church tradition has read that. And to the extent that Jesus was using a reference to Gehenna, this trash dump outside of Jerusalem, which you can go and see today, it's not a trash dump anymore, but you can see Gehenna. He's using this to talk about a deeper reality, and certainly we get into some of the parables of Lazarus and the rich man. We could debate this back and forth, but certainly from a Catholic perspective, there is no question that hell, whatever it happens to be, is a very real thing. Taking it a step further, you know, the harrowing of hell, in the Apostles' Creed, we say that Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. He was crucified, died, and buried. He descended into hell. Like, so this is part of the ancient creeds. You know, sola scriptura, you can debate back and forth, like the verse in Peter that talks about him preaching to those who were in prison. The church tradition speaks, and I'm going to speak largely from a Catholic perspective on this episode, with being conscious of where there might be disagreements with the sola scriptura crowd, you know, and here there's not necessarily a disagreement, but you could make a sola scriptura argument that that's talking about something else.
I want to come back to that, but okay, keep making your point. Let's come back to sola scriptura.
So, hell is a very real place. I don't think that if you're going to be an Orthodox Catholic or an Orthodox Christian, you can get away from the concept of hell. Okay. What is that? Like, how literal do we want to go? So this is where we start to get into some of the gray area. Do we mean that there's literally a lake of fire? Well, the Bible uses that word, but or that phraseology, but clearly you could interpret that metaphorically, and you're not wandering into heresy if you say, I interpret the lake of fire as a metaphor for expressing the horror that is hell, whatever that happens to be. I think that various aspects of the Christian tradition have spoken of hell as separation from God, which, you know, as a soul that is made to for communion with God is of course the most terrible thing you could experience. And, you know, we talk about hell as a eternal thing. I'm not really going to get into annihilationism. Let's, for the purpose of this conversation, say that when we talk about universalism, we're talking about everybody being saved from hell, whether hell is Dante's Inferno for all eternity, or if it's a instantaneous snuffing out of that soul in annihilationism. Annihilationism is at least not compatible with Catholic teaching, so for my purposes, I'm not talking about that. So hell is a very real thing. We believe as Catholics in the harrowing of hell, that Christ set prisoners free from hell. You know, you can interpret that. There's room for interpretation on what exactly that means. But what there isn't necessarily, shockingly enough, a definitive teaching on is who is actually in hell. I know where this came from. This was the church name episode.
Oh, yes.
I don't think that's even up
it's
yet.
It's not posted yet.
Yeah, so I was ranting about church names, then we got into other conversations, and I was referencing a Mark Driscoll tweet about how, you know, Mark Driscoll was tweeting about, and this is why I riffed on this, because I was trying to distance myself a little bit from Mark Driscoll while still glomming onto his point, which seems like the appropriate thing to do if you're going to quote him in the year 2024. But he had made the point of, in relation to the He Gets Us ad, that Jesus washed Judas' feet but still sent him to hell. And I said, I'd maybe make that a little bit less strongly, because we don't know that for sure, that Judas is in hell, and maybe we don't know that anybody's in hell. That's the context I said this in.
There we go.
Okay, so if anybody's in hell, it's probably Judas, but we don't know for sure. So why am I saying that? Like, why am I saying that? First of all, I do think people are in hell. I do think Judas is most likely in hell. I think Adolf Hitler is likely there with him. And I think lots of other people are there too. We'll come back to that in a minute. But the reason I'm very careful with my language there is that I'm also aware of two other things the church teaches, which is that there are two heresies regarding salvation. One of which is to presume on God's mercy. This is where, when I said the term universalism is a little too big, because there are parts of universalism that are heretical. One part of that is heretical is that if somebody comes out and says, definitively, everybody's saved, that's a heresy. You are presuming on God's mercy. The other thing is to despair of God's grace. There's two errors. Now, keep in mind here, and this is going to be a difference from some Protestants out there, in Catholicism, there isn't such a thing as an assurance of salvation. You can fall into mortal sin and lose your salvation. Okay? So, unlike, say, five-point Calvinism that has the perseverance of the saints, which, sorry, Calvinists, is a little bit of a shell game, because when you bring up somebody who was clearly a believer mm-hmm. and wasn't, they say, well, he was never actually saved in the first place. Mm-hmm. Of a shell gate, but putting that aside,
those Protestants that believe you can lose your faith,
yes,
and
there's mixed Protestant belief on this.
Because I think I would land in you can,
yeah. So Catholicism has that just more explicitly stated. So in that sense, it is a sin to presume on God's mercy. In the context of Catholicism, that would look like, I don't need to worry about confession. I don't need to worry about the sacraments because, of course, God's going to save me. That's a sin to hold that belief. And that's a sin to hold that belief at the macro level as well. That, well, yeah, but of course God's going to save everybody. It's also a sin to despair of God's grace, which is, man, you know, I keep falling into the sin or whatever, and yes, I confess it, and yes, I go to the sacraments and I pray and all of that, but I'm such a piece of crap. There's no way. In the end, I'm going to fall. Like, that's a sin, too, to hold that belief. And so I extrapolate that out and say, it's ultimately up to God how all of this works. So I'm going to start to blend from, you know, talking about my aside now into the concepts of universalism a bit. But as we segue into that, one of the things we can think about is the ordinary means of grace. Meaning that what ways has God given his church to present grace to the world? In terms of Catholicism, we would say outside of the church, there is no salvation. It's a stronger dogmatic version of nobody comes to the Father but by me. You know, but same idea is that outside of the church, there is no salvation. Okay, that's a strong statement. And there are Catholics who have, and some who still today would interpret that as literally, if you're not in communion with the Catholic Church, you cannot be saved. I don't think that's a correct interpretation. Why? You know, I would disagree actually very strongly with that interpretation. Why? Because what I look at the ordinary means of salvation, by which I mean the seven sacraments, that is what God has given to us as humans. It is the closer we adhere to the church and the sacraments that God has given us, that's the right thing to do. But we are bound by those. God is not bound by those. And that's the really key thing. And this is where we get into the whole question of the anonymous Christian, of the people who, you know, what about the person who has never, the uncontacted tribes in the Congo or whatever, and they've never heard about Jesus, so they just damned, you know, just from the word go. I don't believe that they are. But I'm not going to say definitively they're in. I'm not going to presume on God's mercy, but I'm going to trust to God's grace that in those cases, God will judge them justly. And I think the same holds true to people who have heard, but through maybe no fault of their own, they've been abused, lied to, whatever. It's like the whole concept of who's saved and who's not is a wildly complicated thing. And so when we get into that, I'm not willing to say definitely that anybody is or isn't. I guess anybody is. I will say that definitely. The Virgin Mary, first and foremost, is in heaven. The saints are in heaven. So I can make some definitive statements on that end. But I'm not willing to say definitely on the other side, because ultimately you don't know. That's not the same as a universalist position, and this might feel like a thin line for people. So let's break down the universalist positions a little bit. There would be the true universalist. It doesn't matter what you believe. You're going to heaven. Everybody's going to heaven, including if you don't believe at all. It's just automatic in. You know, effectively, there is no hell in
okay.
this case.
You're saying that's one version of universalism?
That'd be one, yes. I think that is flat-out heresy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any way of, you know, the variations of this are, well, every path to God is equally valid. Christianity works for me, but if Buddhism works for you, that's great. If nothing works for you, if, you know, sitting and communing with your marijuana plants works for you, like whatever it is, just go with what works for you. That's flat out heresy. Like, that's a lie. That is not what the church teaches. That is not what the Bible teaches. That's not what any lowercase o orthodox version of Christianity has ever taught or will ever teach. That is heresy. Flat out, it's incompatible with the Christian tradition of Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox. All of us together say no to that. Because it just, like, there's no interpretation of outside the church, there's no salvation, or nobody comes to the Father but by me. It makes Jesus irrelevant. It makes, you know, religion just a personal preference. And it's not. And here's one of the key differences. Because even if in the anonymous Christian world of the uncontacted tribe, God may save those people, but it would be better if they had been saved through the ordinary means of salvation. This is probably a controversial statement. I'm going to make it anyway with apologies. I believe that many, many, many Protestants will be in heaven because they have a genuine faith in God. I also believe it would be better if they were Catholic. And I know I don't mean that to like spit and make anybody feel bad. I'm not trying to be arrogant with that statement. But it's also like, if I actually believe in what the Catholic Church teaches, how could I hold any other position than to say, yes, I think you have a genuine faith in God. I think you're saved. I think all of that great stuff. I think God's communicating his grace to you. But it would still be better if you were Catholic. Like, I wouldn't be honest if that wasn't my position.
You know how in Catholicism you have to go to just one thing. You have to go to Mass,
yeah,
as part of,
right,
like, or it's a sin to not go. And of course, in the Protestant churches, I feel like there's an importance to going to church. But if you miss because you're on summer vacation, not the end of the world, right?
Right.
And then there's also the confession aspect. So if you miss Mass, you can confess, good,
yep,
to go. So I'm just going to ask you straight out, for me specifically. Where would you, a person like, just
how,
like
how
me,
does that work out?
What would you think about my salvation? Me?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so, and it's an uncomfortable conversation, but you're asking. So yeah. I'll give you an honest answer,
yeah,
you know, for what I actually believe. Like, if we're to establish a range from the faithful Catholic, and I'm going to use that very clearly because the person who has never heard of God but lives a faithful life is far closer to salvation than the Catholic who is, you know, an evil person. We've seen many, many, many of them. So the faithful Catholic, if that's one end of the spectrum, and the person who's never heard, like, there's many steps along the way there. The imperfect Catholic, the faithful Protestant or faithful Orthodox, I guess, you know, if we were to be technical with it, we'd put the faithful Orthodox a step nearer because they have genuine sacraments through apostolic succession. You know, the faithful Protestant, like, and you even see this in the Easter Vigil. There's a series of prayers, and it begins with the Holy Father and the clergy and the laity, and then it goes into our separated brethren, the Christians who are outside of the church, and then it goes into the Jews as like you know, people who God did reveal his salvation to, and then those who acknowledge God, and then those who don't acknowledge God. And then I believe that there's our political leaders are a step below, like they come next, which I think is funny. Like they're worse than atheists. I don't think that's the intended interpretation, but I enjoy it.
No, I've never been to confession.
Right. So like you, but you're still within the revelation of God. So for all of us, we're all dependent on God's grace. I think that as a Protestant, you are outside of the best expression of God's grace through his church. But it's not a binary, right? Does that make sense for what my position, what I'm trying to say?
Not exactly. You could be hard on me.
I'm not trying to sugarcoat it.
I guess I'm asking, like, so you think I do go to heaven?
As much as I can say that about anybody. Yeah. I think you have a genuine faith. I think that your
purgatory
faith,
first though.
Yes. Again, whatever purgatory happens to be. I think you have a genuine faith. I think that you have a genuine faith, and this is maybe the key thing that is based out of the Christian revelation. It is an imperfect form, and so is mine, of course, but there's a difference between I genuinely believe the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, is the primary means of Christ's salvation on earth. So to the extent that you are outside of that, that's not great. But that doesn't, that's not the same as saying, I think you're not saved. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you know, are there, I'm sure the answer is yes, but I'm just not aware of this. Are there Catholic missionaries that specifically minister to Protestants trying to bring them over?
I mean, there's certainly apologetics, like, Dave Armstrong is somebody I'm aware of, and he has a book. He has a number of books, but the one book that you see quite a bit is, I think it's like Biblical Answers for Catholic Questions. Mm-hmm. That's a powerful apologetics tool, because what it essentially does is it seeks to defend Catholic doctrine via the Bible. But of course, we're not sola scriptura. So like I have things I believe that aren't necessarily explicitly rooted in scripture. I don't believe they contradict scripture. But like if I'm going to try and evangelize or be engage in apologetics with a Protestant, there's two things I want to do. I want to A, use the Bible, and B, use the Protestant Bible. So like if I'm like, oh, you know, yeah, purgatory is totally biblical. Look at this verse in Maccabees. That doesn't mean anything to you. Like you don't believe that, maybe you do after we've done the Deutero series, but as a generic Protestant, you don't believe that Maccabees is divine scripture on the level of other things. So if I'm going to actually make an argument to you and we need to ground that in something we both hold to be a source of truth.
I have a thought on purgatory, but one side note on sola scriptura.
Yeah.
I just heard this on a Protestant podcast, but I think it's a point you could use, and I don't know that I've ever heard you use it. This person was saying, even though Protestants tend to hold to sola scriptura, whereas Catholics add on tradition or history or the early church fathers, something that Protestants are forgetting is that the reason we have the Bible, have you used this before?
Yeah, I have.
I couldn't remember. We got the Bible from the early church fathers and the councils.
Correct.
And so, yeah, I feel like that was a pretty good...
It's 100% correct.
It's a pretty good argument. So how can we say we only hold to the Bible if we only have this version of the Bible from what those early church fathers did?
Right, right. Yeah, there was no definitive canon of scripture for the first few hundred years.
Right.
And the Bible... And this is like when we talked about what the facts, if you listen to that episode, this is a piece of evidence that's not going to be remotely convincing to anybody who believes in sola scriptura, but makes the rest of us who don't feel very smug, is that the Bible never references itself as the sole source of authority. So, I don't expect that to be convincing, but it is nonetheless true.
You were just mentioning purgatory, so I'm going to redirect back to universalism. My family member who I was talking with had said, well, maybe purgatory is real. And that is God's means for universalism. So
that's the Rob Bell belief. Like Rob Bell, and that's such a dumb book. It's so badly written. I hate that we're still talking about
love
it.
Wins.
Yeah, I hate that we're still talking about it all these years later, but it was influential. You know, Rob Bell's belief, he wouldn't put it this way, but I think I was newly Catholic at that time or exploring, and I came away from that horrible book. And I say horrible because I think he's an awful writer. I mean, the content's not good either, but just the quality of his writing offended me more than the actual theology. Rob Bell invented purgatory without meaning to.
Yes, because his argument is there is something, like, you don't get to go straight to heaven, but yeah, you can kind of work some things out to get to heaven.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think he actually said you do go to hell, but hell is not permanent. I think that's his main argument.
Yes, it
hell is real, but not permanent.
Rob Bell invented Protestant purgatory without meaning to,
yeah,
and doesn't actually believe in hell.
So, because I think we started where you said there's different versions of universalism, the version that you started with is everyone goes straight to heaven. No one agrees with that. Was the second one you're going to say this Rob Bell version?
Yeah, I mean, that's a version, you know, and certainly I think from a Catholic perspective, if, like, let's forget the poor uncontacted tribe in Africa for a second. When we talk about universalism, like, let's get raw here. You're saying Adolf Hitler is in heaven. You're saying child rapists are in heaven. You're saying serial abusers are in heaven. Okay. So, you know, this isn't like sunshine and rainbows. My poor Buddhist neighbor might go to hell because he's not technically a Christian. Like, you're talking the worst monsters who ever lived are also going to heaven. Like, that's what you're signing up for if you're going to be a universalist. So let's at least play the game, you know, with a not a, a loaded die. Like, yeah, the poor sweet grandma down the street who never went to church but was so kind to everyone. Like, that's easy mode. You know, hard mode is go argue for the Nazi guard who ran the ovens at Auschwitz. You get to argue for him. Okay. Those are the people you get to argue for if you're going to be a universalist. Like, you know, you're going to play this game on hard mode. So in that case, because I'll make that argument, it's not ultimately what I believe. Remember, we're going to come back to that. But since I can't despair of God's grace in any case, it's possible if those people are saved, whatever purgatory happens to be, there's my equivocal language again, because I'm hesitant to say, because it's not, there's no definitive teaching on what exactly purgatory is, but whatever it happens to be, they're going to have a rough time during it. If it's a Dante-esque purgatory, they have millennia there. But remember, the key feature about, and one of the things I love deeply about the comedy, is that where are the gates of heaven in Dante's cosmology? They are on the outside of purgatory. You pass through the gates of heaven to enter purgatory. Everybody in purgatory is saved. That is what the church teaches, whatever purgatory happens to be. If you're in purgatory, you are saved. Full stop. So if Adolf is in purgatory right now and will likely be there for some time, he's got a long road to go, you know. So yes, purgatory would be a part of that universalist belief, and I think that's a way that you can make that belief, make that argument in a way that is compatible with the Christian tradition. Okay, but you know, so when you think about that, then, like, as you start to slice and dice universalism, and this is some of what I've gotten into a little bit, at least in the past, is you can have different positions. So ultimately, what we're describing there is an agnostic position that says we don't know for sure. You could have an optimistic agnosticism that allows that, yes, some might be damned, but I don't believe they are. You can have a pessimistic agnosticism, which I think is probably the closest to my own position, which doesn't shut the door on God's grace, because I just can't. Like, you just can't make that definitive statement, because no. But nevertheless thinks that the weight of the Christian tradition and scripture and human nature and everything else that we understand from supporting doctrines lends itself to the idea that there are people in hell. I mean, that's my own position in here. All of those could be classed under the universalist bucket. So, you know, mine would be on the outer fringes of it, but if you were to put a very large tent around it, it's there, but it's a million miles away from the everybody's in approach.
Okay. I had some Bible verses I wanted to ask you about. I'm not sure if now is the best time. So if you're making a point, I want to come back to this.
Well, why don't I share my position and then we can come back to the Bible verses.
Okay, that sounds good.
So here's what I actually believe. And I've brought up this idea of sin. It's really derived from Aquinas, that sin is an act of uncreation. Okay, so you can think of, like, if you have a blank piece of paper, every sin that you commit punches a hole in that piece of paper. And you punch enough holes, the paper doesn't exist anymore. I'm not talking about annihilationism, so don't get too in love with the metaphor. We'll come back to that in a second. Grace, then, the sacraments restore those holes. You know, some mortal sin, you can fall out of grace, and you can, through grace, be restored. So sin is an act of uncreation. I think that's the key thing, is that when you sin, you are uncreating yourself in a very real way. So you are created in God's image, but through sin, you punch holes in what it means to be God's image bearer. You cease to bear God's image as perfectly as you would if you had never sinned or were in a perfect state of grace. One of the things I love about Dante is that in Dante, everybody gets what they want. It's a very, very profound truth in Dante, is that the people who are in hell are miserable, but would be more miserable anywhere else. I actually think Dante's stumbled on, and stumbled implies it's an accident, he was a genius, so I doubt it's accidental. I think he's hit on a deep truth about how can a loving God, quote-unquote, send people to hell. And I think the answer, and C.S. Lewis talks about this a little bit too, that if there are people in hell, the people are there because they choose to be, which sounds bizarre, but they would be more miserable in heaven. If hell is what you get when you have uncreated yourself to such a way where the enjoyment of heaven is not only impossible for you, but would be a torture to you. You have uncreated yourself as God's image bearer, where the only eternity that is open to you is eternal separation from God. That's what I believe. So do I believe that people are in hell? Yes. And I believe they are in hell because mortal sin is the state of uncreation that makes eternity with God impossible. God respects our freedom to uncreate ourselves. That's what I believe. So I don't think that when we talk about hell, we're talking about the sweet old lady down the street who just never quite figured it out. We're talking, but then on the other hand, let's even take the sweet old lady down the street, because this is one of the traps we can fall into in this conversation, is to undervalue the effect of sin. Like, let's not soft sell sin. You know, mortal sin's a big deal. Like, sin matters. You uncreate yourself. Like, that's if St. Thomas is correct, or even in the ballpark of correct about the nature of sin, that it doesn't exist, it is literal non-existence, then even your sweet old grandma down the street, who has lived for 80 years and no doubt sinned a bunch, has done a whole lot of uncreation. What does that mean in eternity? Does that mean she's instantly damned if she's not a Christian? No, I'm not going to say that, because I don't understand how God's grace works. But there's some uncreation, even in your best case scenario, there's some real things that have to be done with. And that's even when the universalists play on easy mode, what they ultimately wind up doing is soft selling sin. And that's a big problem. So if you're going to hold out for the possibility of God's grace saving everyone, then you still have to deal with the reality of sin. And that's what the universalists on the heretical extreme completely fail to do. So that's my position, is you uncreate yourself to the point where hell is the only possible existence for you.
All right, good. Back to the conversation I was having with this family member 4 days ago. I was a little bit on the spot, and I know there's a Bible verse that says something like, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have. And I felt a little bit unprepared in the moment when I'm just like, I mean, this conversation came out of nowhere when they were asking about what happens to people that have never heard. The first verse that came to my mind is in Romans 1. Do you remember this one about nature?
Yeah.
I'm just going to read it real quick so we're all on the same page. The wrath, this is Romans 1, 18, and I'll read a few verses here. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So I kind of talk through this idea, and then they were like, well, that does kind of make sense when it comes to maybe all different gods are directing, like,
right.
You know, and so this verse did not work very well. So I'm like, oh boy. So I'm still kind of like Googling what else. And in Romans 10, so still Paul, still the book of Romans, there's this verse that we've heard before where, we're in 10, starting at verse 12. For there is no difference between Jews and Gentiles. The same Lord is the Lord of all and richly blesses all who call on him. For everyone who calls in the name of the Lord will be saved. How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? So I'll stop there. But it almost feels, and I know like this, I know what I'm about to say isn't true, but these almost seem like contradictory thoughts. On one hand, you're saying, Nature will do it. It will get them to the right place. And in verse 10, it seems like, no, they need to actually hear from somebody about Jesus. What are your thoughts on these two verses?
Well,
or these two ideas?
So a couple of thoughts on what you're describing. To say first, in a conversation like that, I'd actually refer you to the What the Facts episode we just did, because what's happening there is nothing you say is probably going to be convincing, mm-hmm. you know, and that doesn't mean it's not worth saying, you know, it's worth having those answers. Probably a follow-up because I'm reading more and Ian McGilchrist's got some good thoughts on that, too much to get into in this episode. But there's probably not an answer you can give that's going to give that family member the aha moment. Yeah. That's it, because there's already a narrative. There's already a belief.
Yeah. Like they've come into the conversation exactly. Not believing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's no evidence that you can give that's going to change that. The narrative has to change. So I think you did fine. You have a give the response, show that there is a rational basis for this, but it's a narrative difference, not an evidence difference. So I'd reassure yourself on that.
What about those two ideas, both by Paul, both in Romans? So, they contradict?
No, because Paul, and this is one of the problems we all get into when it comes to looking up individual verses. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that all of Paul's letters are, and really all of the books of the Bible, are to various degrees sustained arguments. Okay? So Paul's making a sustained argument. What's the book of Romans about? Well, it's really not a book about, I'm going to make the N.T. Wright argument here, it's not a book about individual salvation. It's about the relationship of justification for God's covenant family and how that involves the Gentiles. You know, so the idea is that where Paul starts out with is this idea that everybody is called to account. You know, and I'm probably butchering this. It's been a while since I've dug much into Roman scholarship. But the idea being that everybody's called to account, not just those who have heard the truth, but those who have not. You don't have an excuse because God has revealed himself, and this is where we get into the concept of natural revelation and divine revelation. God's revealed himself through natural revelation. Then Paul's going to get into Abrahamic covenant and the narrative of the Abrahamic narrative and the covenant relationship with the Jews and leading that up to the new covenant with Christ and the Gentiles being welcomed into that. But you have to start with this idea that everybody's from the same starting point, because that's what Paul's actually after, is this sustained argument about that. It's less about the individual salvation, because let's remember too that as much as we like to talk in terms of individual salvation, the actual theology is not an individual based salvation. It's God saving his church. That's also why I hold unquestionably to the idea of outside the church there is no salvation. We just don't necessarily know who's in the church. You know, but that's very true. You know, Paul is a lot less concerned about individual salvation than he is God's covenant people who are saved and was the Jews and now is the Jews and the Gentiles through the church.
All right, we covered a lot tonight. Do you think we answered it mostly?
I think I clarified my aside.
Yeah, exactly. So, I feel like there may be more questions out there, but
probably.
I think we hit the main points we planned to discuss tonight.
I agree.
Listeners, if you have more, you can write us at feedback@thesapphirechristian.com. Let us know if you want us to do a follow-up, because I feel like there's could be more to unpack.
Yeah, it's a big topic.
Yeah.
It's a big topic. But,
all right, well, yeah. Good job, Ben. I like those notes. Thank you. All right, listeners, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiVono.
We are the Sci-Fi Christians. Signing off.
I have a question for you after the music, but you may or may not want to. It may or may not be interesting for the air, so I'll pause.
All right, yeah, just pause right now.
You said you were looking at Catherine, St. Catherine art. I was just curious what your story was on that.
Yeah, I happened to be at the Minneapolis Institute of Art this past weekend.
Oh,
man, you know what? It's great that you're bringing this up, actually, because
I'm just looking at what saint it was.
You recently, which episode did we talk about? Mary, oh, of course, the Rosary episode that I'll be posting here in the main feed next. And you talked about how Mary is considered the Queen of Heaven.
Yes.
I never actually, I should back up. I may have heard that before, but I felt like that was the first time I was hearing that title given to Mary. And I walk into one of the rooms, and have you been to the Minneapolis Institute of Art?
Not for a long time.
Okay, well, they kind of have the rooms semi-themed, like here's a certain period of time, here's a bunch of religious art. You walk into one of the first big paintings you see is a painting from, you know, I don't know what year. 1600s, 1700s, I don't know. And it's Jesus crowning Mary. There's angels playing music at their feet. And it was one of the most moving pictures I saw there.
Yeah.
And so that came up. And then we saw some other artwork. And there was a picture depicting something that happened in the life of Catherine of Alexandria, I believe.
Yep.
It kind of rung a bell, but I mixed up the Catherines.
Yeah, I went to used to go to St. Catherine Drexel Parish.
Yeah, so I think you said this, but listeners, I texted Ben to ask if he knew this saint. Like, I thought that was the saint that his church was named after. It was not. So no. There it is. So yeah, so I think I saw a lot of Catholic art that was, well, I can't say a lot, but I'm guessing a lot of it was Catholic art. But this specific one about the Queen of Heaven, I found to be moving.
Yeah, I think that I'm glad you're exploring that. I think it would be, it's a good thing universally for more Protestants to at least come to peace with Marian theology. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know when I was Protestant, like that was just a no-go zone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much that you're missing by that. This isn't an argument to become Catholic. This is an argument to welcome Mary as, you know, your mother, because she is. Mm-hmm. And I think that the other piece of art, yeah, you know, I've seen, I don't know this exact painting you're referring to, but I've seen other ones like that, and it's very moving. But one of my favorite pieces of religious art is the Pietà, Michelangelo's, you know, marble carving of Mary holding the body of Christ off the cross. It's like, it's a beautiful piece of artwork. You can get that. You can get the part about, you know, Jesus suffering on the cross. You can get the excellence of the craftsmanship. But until you get Mary, you don't get the Pietà. Like this is the woman that God chose to be his mother and to hold him in that moment. And then in turn gave her to all of us. Like it's an incredible, incredible work of art. You don't get it until you start to understand who Mary is.
I don't have an answer for this question, although it could be that we just, in the Rosary episode, we had just been discussing Mary. But I think the question that I'm left with is, why did that move me? What about the image? If, like you're saying, in Protestant theology, we don't take Mary as seriously as we should.
Because it's true.
Yeah. So what is it about that I saw? I see Jesus crowning her, the angels around her. What sparked something in me?
My flippant answer is that it's true. Like, there's something very deeply true on there. And of course, I believe it's true in a literal sense. And, the key thing about that is that, like, we honor Mary because Jesus honored Mary. And that's part of what you're describing in that artwork. This isn't idolatry. This is the mother of your God. Like, that's one of the most ancient names for Mary is Theotokos, the mother of God.
Mm-hmm.
Not mother of God the Father, of course. You know, we don't believe Mary was the fourth member of the Trinity by any means, the quadrinity at that point. But she is the mother of God, and that Jesus, in turn, has honored his mother and wants you to honor his mother. And it's not just a duty thing. Like, there's something deep about that calls out to you. Like, that, and that's part of the beauty of the rosary, is that, you know, the rosary brings us to Mary, who points us to Christ. It's like devotion to Mary becomes devotion to Christ. And why? Because when we love the mother of God, we love God. It's like, it's this deep mystery about that. And it's profoundly true. It's profoundly true. And then, you know, I mentioned this a little bit in the rosary episode, but still have been thinking over the last few weeks more about the wedding feast of Cana, which is one of the luminous mysteries. And it's like, yeah, sometimes it's hard to go to God. And so sometimes you, not that you can't, like, that's the Protestant, the flawed interpretation of Catholic theology that a lot of Protestants have, is that we think we can't go directly to God. Of course you can. Sometimes dad's a little intimidating. You got to go talk to mom, you know, and what does mom do? Do whatever he tells you. It's like mom points us to God every time. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. And so what you saw is, I think it speaks to you because of how true it is.
All right. Thank you. And goodbye.
Goodbye.